This holiday season, thousands of LGBTQ youth are out in the cold because they were thrown out of their homes when they came out or were outed to their unforgiving families.
To combat this problem, the Chicago charity Care for Friends is inviting folks to spend a night in tents out in the cold in the middle of February to raise money to support homeless LGBTQ youth. Today, J.D. Miller, homeless youth activist and chairperson for Care for Friends, a nonprofit serving all homeless people with an emphasis on LGBTQ youth, joins us to talk about the complex nature of what it takes to motivate people to give, not just during the holiday season, but all year long.
Plus, is it okay to share your charitable donations on social media?
Oh, balls! A bone marrow transplant recipient's sperm is 100% a DNA match to his donor.
And the conflict over Democratic presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg's volunteering for the Salvation Army. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people like you. For the past 15 years, our microphones, hard drives, mixers, and cables have fearlessly been recording podcasts with thousands of legendary LGBTQ artists. Right now, we need your help to save Feast of Fun. Two of our microphones are broken, our equipment and our website have had it, and are in urgent need of repairs in order to continue. This holiday season, please consider stuffing your stocking with Feast of Fun. Go to GoFundMe.com/SaveFeastOfFun and pledge any amount today. Thank you.
Christmas is here, and almost half of all homeless youth identify as LGBTQ. This holiday season, thousands of young people will be left out in the cold because they were thrown out of their homes when they were outed or came out to their unforgiving families. Our guest today is the chairman of the board for Care for Friends, a nonprofit that caters to homeless people with an emphasis on youth in a very exciting and interesting way. Welcome to Feast of Fun.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
J.D. Miller.
It's
Sorry,
great to be
got
here.
Got your name out here. So, J.D., you're a longtime listener of the show.
Yes, and supporter.
And supporter. And you started listening to this podcast when you were in the closet.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
And so Feast of Fun kind of helped you find your voice as a queer person.
Absolutely. I think you guys create a community, a safe space for people to learn about new and scary ideas. And so, I think we're born gay, and I was probably gay my whole life, but hadn't admitted it to myself yet.
Sure.
And so you were a great place to start exploring that before I had to go out in the world and explore it live and in person.
So we're like the kiddie pool before you dove into the Olympic sized pool and did laps.
Absolutely. Just a splash.
We're the jacuzzi getting you warm. So tell me about Care for Friends. It's an interesting idea of fundraising for homeless people and homeless youth is that you invite people sort of the same way that they raise money for AIDS with marathons to experience what it's like to be homeless by camping out on the lawn of your organization.
Yeah. So you described it exactly right. I think we're always looking for interesting ways to get people interested in an idea. And with the issue of homelessness, one of the things we talked about is what is it like to actually be homeless? And so we looked at the calendar. We picked one of the coldest days of the year, February 21st. And we said, what would it be like if we had to sleep outside? Now, we know you and your listeners and my friends really don't want to have that true, authentic homeless experience. So we set up a bunch of tents on the lawn. This year, we'll pitch 200 tents. We'll have some campfires and hot beverages and s'mores and things
catering,
like that.
Catering, some inflatable mattresses.
Bonfires?
Entertainment.
Lots of bonfires, yeah. So it's a nice kind of camping experience. And if it's too cold, you can go right inside our building, and we've got heated bathrooms and places to sleep. But
does that defeat the purpose? Though, like, because you're trying to get people a sense of what it's like to have no resources and to be out in the cold, but you're making it comfortable for them to participate in this.
Well, you know, Fausto, I'll tell you, you can be authentic and not raise any money, or you can make it nice for people and have a ton of people participate. So I decided I want 200 people to come fundraise with me instead of the 5 that would really do the authentic experience.
Sure.
So we made room for 200 people to sleep, and having some of the creature comforts, you know, makes it easier for people to come participate.
Just part of it is about building a community of people interested in helping youth, and you do that by bringing people together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So who proposed this idea initially to Care for Friends? Because it didn't start out that way.
No, it didn't. So Care for Friends has been dealing with homeless issues in Chicago for about 50 years. I took over as chairman of the board about 7 years ago. And we were going through a staff change, and I had a new executive director coming on board. And as with all nonprofits, you know, there's never enough money. But to pay the new executive director's salary, I had a shortfall in money that I needed to raise really quickly. And so I threw it out as just a random idea one day and said, hey, what if we, you know, it's getting cold. What if we just go sleep out on the lawn and ask people to sponsor us? You know, every hour out in the cold, they can throw some money our way.
I can imagine that was not well received at first.
Well, you know, I thought it was a joke, but I was surprised that the people around the table all said, JD, if you're willing to do that, let's go do it. You know, let's do it in 2 weeks.
So initially you were just being sarcastic.
I thought it was a throwaway idea. Yeah.
Well, those crazy ideas sometimes are the ones that really work.
Yeah.
The ones that, like, cause you're thinking outside the box and it appeals to people. And I had read about it a few years ago. And I thought, well, that really is an interesting concept. That really is something that, you know, so when you told me about it, when you wrote to us, I was like, yeah, let's have them on.
Yeah. So the first year there were 6 of us. And even though I had been working with we have about 12,000 homeless guests a year come through our facility. And although I thought I knew a lot about homelessness that night, you know, we really wrestled with questions about what would it be like, you know, if we were truly out here, where would we sleep? Where would I go to the bathroom? How would I shower? You know, all of that kind of stuff. And we were doing some, back then it was Twitter posts. We had a little hashtag CFF sleeps, which is Care for Friends sleeps, that we're posting these pictures on. And suddenly I found out that everyone was really interested in it. And so the next year, 6 became 25 that said, I want to experience that too. And it grew and grew and grew and grew. So our lawn is at capacity about 200.
What did you learn the first night that you did this about being homeless?
You know, I learned 7-Eleven is the mecca for homeless people. We're right in the middle of Lincoln Park. We're at Clark and Fullerton, and it's a very gentrifying neighborhood. 50 years ago, when Care for Friends started, Lincoln Park was not the Lincoln Park we know of today. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're next door to a $3 million home, and people are less excited to have, you know, homeless people in the neighborhood. And so a lot of businesses and, you know, they call it aggressive architecture, have really shifted things. Like, you have to have a key to go to the Starbucks bathroom, and you've got to, you know, the park benches all have these little ridges that are going to make it hard for you to lay down or an armrest in the middle of it. And so when you really start looking around your neighborhood for that, you realize how aggressive it is to people without homes. And then you find some, you know, glints of gold, like a 7-Eleven who's constantly saying, come on in, and we've got dollar coffee and we've got $5 pizzas and you can use our bathroom. And you find some small business owners that way too, who are really open to serving their community.
Was there a lot of pushback from the nonprofit to start this? Or, I mean, it's grown to something pretty sizable now, but imagine the first couple of years, it wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, I think the nonprofit was excited about it. We knew in the first year that it had caught on, as it had caught the imaginations of people. And now it's become our largest fundraiser of the year. This year, we're expecting to cross $250,000 raised in the event.
Oh, wow.
Which helps us, you know, serve 12,000 homeless people a year, helps us get 85% of them housed within 6 months, hook them up with mental and physical health, do job training,
wow,
a whole lot of stuff.
So you're really turning around people's lives.
Yeah. So we also talk about hashtag more than a meal. And really what we're trying to do is create a community where people can come together and get connected to life-changing resources. There are a lot of organizations in the city that can address your homeless need and get you the job or get you the housing. But a lot of homeless people are afraid to access them. You know, part of being homeless is being afraid of authority, being afraid of people treating you poorly. And so, you know, when a shelter's first question to you is, show me your ID. What's your name? Sign this form.
What's your religion? What's your gender identity? Are you a homosexual? A
lot of that kind of stuff, yeah. Right? you know, even though it may be an organization that has the resources there to help you, you're turned away right away. You're afraid of it. And so what we're doing at Care for Friends is we do a hot meal that we invite about 150 people for lunch each day. They come in, they spend time with us. We don't just do a cafeteria. They, you know, come in for 2 or 3 hours, spend the afternoon with us, and then mixed in at our tables are representatives from some of these other organizations. And over time, we build a trusting relationship that if you've had lunch with us for 2 or 3 weeks, now I can introduce you to that drug and alcohol counselor, or now I can introduce you to a housing provider, and you're willing to accept that gift.
What do you make about, who was it, the celebrity that was handing out like vegan meals to homeless people in Los Angeles? And they were like, I want mashed potatoes. And, you know, like, what kind of food are you guys serving?
We have a wide variety of food. We try and actually we have a celebrity TV chef who in Chicago who's really active in the kitchen as well. So it's really taught us a lot about nutrition and thinking about the needs of homeless people and what kind of nutritional needs they actually have. But, you know, when you think about that celebrity chef, the question is, who are you really serving? And are you trying to serve the homeless person, or are you trying to serve yourself and your ego? Mm-hmm. So
you're not doing, you're doing meals that they want to eat.
Absolutely. And good and tasty food.
Yeah.
You know, you and I were talking earlier about clothes stores that are like, buy a pair of shoes and we'll give a pair of shoes away to a poor person. And what's interesting about that is it's much more a marketing campaign than it's trying to do good. Mm. Homeless person maybe doesn't want those shoes. And by the way, the shoes that you bought for yourself are not the shoes that actually are getting delivered to the homeless shelter. It's a totally different quality and different kind of cost. Mm. And so, you know, when I think about that celebrity, it's what's their intention, and do they intend to do good in the community, or do they intend to just bolster their reputation?
Well, that's a tricky thing. And at the core of today's show is this holiday season. I see so many people, you know, with great intentions. And I think about, you know, Pete Buttigieg ringing the bell for Salvation Army,
right,
doing a photo op in 2017. He had been helping raise funds for the Salvation Army for 3 years before that. And the backlash that's happening, and how people say, if you're going to help somebody for a charity, don't treat this as content for your social media. Do it because it comes from the goodness of your heart. However, these nonprofit organizations like yours understand that maybe a little show business, a little appealing to people's vanity can actually get them over that hump to donate, to take action, because the ultimate crime is not money. It's not it's apathy.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're right there. And, you know, as someone who runs a nonprofit, I'll take the help any way I can get it. And, it, you know, if the way I'm going to get help for our service is by giving you a little press or giving you an Instagram mm-hmm. moment, I'm going to capitalize on that. But it's interesting to see that, you know, there's a season of giving. Mm-hmm. Right now it's Christmas and Thanksgiving, and everyone wants that holiday moment to say, I took the kids down to the shelter and I served a meal, or I handed out a pair of socks. People are still homeless in May and June and July, and people aren't thinking about those homeless people at that point either. And so, you know, one of our challenges when we think about fundraising and how to sustain an organization for a year or a lifetime is not just to have support on Thanksgiving and Christmas, but how to use that moment to really support us, you know, all year long.
How do you sort of fight this exploitation of people in the most vulnerable moments? People call it poverty tourism, where someone who is in the most vulnerable place in their lives when they're homeless is being exploited by somebody who wants to have a photo op, or, you know, is superficial with their needs to try to help them. And they're not actually helping them. They're just helping themselves.
Yeah.
How do you guys like fight against that?
I'm glad you asked that question, because it's one that we talk about a lot. We want our guests to feel that they've always been in a space of dignity and respect. And so one of the rules we have at Care for Friends is you're never allowed to take a photo of one of our guests. Now, the flip side of that is if you're coming with maybe you're coming by yourself or your family or your company to volunteer, you want something you're going to put on Facebook or Instagram. So one of our tricks is to really figure out where can we create Instagrammable volunteer moments that aren't going to exploit those people. So the sleep out is a great one. you know, we will have a few homeless speakers that night, but mostly we'll have great, you know, campfires and tents and backdrops that'll be great for people to, you know, get that kind of Instagram fix out of. And it's not at the expense of an individual person that's, you know, going to be exposed in really one of their most vulnerable moments.
Mm. Well, that's really profound.
So the sleep out, you guys provide the tents? Are you providing like sleeping bags? Did you bring your own sleeping bags? What's the, because I imagine, you know, February 21st, Chicago, Illinois, can be mighty cold.
You know, it's more marketing than reality, probably. Okay. So we tell people who are participating, you bring a sleeping bag and, you know, wear your own winter coat and we'll take care of the rest of what you need. The truth is, I've done this will be my sixth year in a row sleeping out. And by the time I get in my bag at night, it's, you know, I'm taking off my coat, I'm taking off my shirt, and I'm waking up sweaty. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, you're supposed to sleep in the sleeping bag naked. I don't know if you know that, you know, depending on what kind of sleeping bag it is, because you're supposed to get the ones that reflect the heat back onto you.
Yeah. I mean,
what? Well, yeah, they say that if you sleep nude in your sleeping bag, you'll be more warm, that the clothes actually, you know.
So are you recommending like a homeless person take their clothes off? I mean, it is a life or death experience when you take your jacket off because somebody might steal it.
That's
from
true.
You.
Well, so actually what happens is you actually do take off a lot of clothes and mm-hmm. keep them in your sleeping bag.
Okay.
So when you wake up in the morning, you have something else warm to put on. But inside a sleeping bag in a tent that's got six or eight other people in it, you generate a lot of heat. I don't know, Mark, were you a Cub Scout or a Boy Scout?
I was a Cub Scout, yeah.
So you probably learned about rubbing two sticks together and getting really warm.
Oh.
What?
But you also probably had, you know, that inside a tent experience. Staying warm is not the challenge of being homeless on February 21st. It's much more about
trying to get a little sleep, because I imagine some people are partying down.
Oh, people are partying. People are snoring. I always have to remind people, you know, you're in this little tent that feels really cozy, but the tent right next door to you is 3 inches away and a very thin piece of fabric separating mm-hmm. you. So keeping your voices down and keeping the noise down and being respectful of your neighbors is part of the,
you know,
part of the fun.
Funny thing is that this podcast started out as a sleepover art event many, many years ago at Randolph Street Gallery here in Chicago. The Radical Fairies had a fundraiser for this avant-garde experimental art museum, and we had invited people to do a slumber party.
Really?
To have an urban experience in Wicker Park in this art gallery, and we were raising funds for the gallery. And it was, you know, a lot of discussion about homelessness as well. But a lot of people who go to fairy gatherings and bring their tents were setting up their tents in the gallery and spending the night together. And that was a difficult night, I'll tell you that.
Did you sleep at all?
I slept a little bit, yeah. But my friend Karen, who was sharing the tent with me, she was like, quit sawing wood.
You know, it's funny to hear that story, because a lot of times when we hear about LGBT lives, mm-hmm. homelessness is kind of an undercurrent that we don't talk a lot about. But, you know, so many RuPaul's Drag Race queens, part of that little bio is, you know, I was couch surfing, or I was homeless when I got the call to be on this season or that season. And
Hashtag Tyra Sanchez. Her friend was trying to get rid of her.
Yeah.
Because she was, you know, so he put together her audition video and tape and sent it to World of Wonder, and that's why she got on Drag Race.
Get this girl off my couch, for sure.
But get her some tea.
And that's kind of the nature, typically, of LGBT homelessness, isn't it? It's not, they're always, like, living on the street, but they don't really, they're staying at friends' houses, they're on somebody's couch, they're going from place to place, maybe they're having sex with somebody in exchange for a place to sleep.
Absolutely. So, yeah, the research says about 41% of LGBT kids are exchanging sex for somewhere to live at some point in their homelessness. And the challenge is, unlike a lot of straight homeless youth, there's really not a social safety net of other family members who will take them in, or family friends who will take them in. We don't think about it in Chicago, this big progressive city, but 25% of LGBT kids are still getting kicked out of their parents' house when they come out.
Wow.
And how much is that? 27?
25%.
25%. One out of every four.
Yeah. And so a lot of times that's, you know, that's out in the suburbs. And they migrate downtown where they don't have any family. They don't know anyone. And suddenly they need a place to stay.
So do they typically just go to like the epicenters of gay culture, like Boys Town and Andersonville and places, and just hang out?
Go to the bars, try pick someone up to spend the night with. And then, you know, a one night stand becomes a, can I stay a little bit longer and stay a little bit longer? And it's, you know, it's kind of the seedy underside of of what life has to be like sometimes.
I was talking to an old Puerto Rican queen. She got kicked out of her house in the 80s. She grew up in Humboldt Park, and she goes, back in the day, it was like that first, like they knew you were queer, and that first night that you spent the entire night out, they're like, oh, you don't need to sleep here anymore, do you? Get out. And so she was like, we were like living six of us in an apartment. And, you know, it's much different back in the 80s. I think it probably was the city was a little bit more affordable.
Yep.
And, you know, the prices for rent are, you know, astronomical in some senses compared to what they were back in the day. And these, you know, kids don't necessarily have the means.
Absolutely.
They say that these millennials are the poorest generation to come.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I was walking home from the gym the other day. It was 10 in the morning, and I was walking by an SRO. And there was
an SRO for people that don't know.
Oh yeah. Single residence occupancy. So like one of those apartments that you can rent by the day. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's one in the neighborhood, and I was walking by, and you know, a guy is standing outside leaning against the door, and he kind of watches me walk by and says, "Hey baby, you look real cute, but I'm real tired. So can you just give me $20? And it seemed kind of, I didn't know if I was supposed to be, you know, upset about that, offended by that, or if that was a compliment.
You were
in there.
A lot of work is what he was trying to say.
Well, they do call it a job for a reason.
Right.
But that is the reality. Yeah. Of, you know, where was he going to sleep that night? Mm-hmm. He was actually at the building. He wanted, you know, 20 more bucks so he could spend, you know, he could pay for the rent that night. Mm. But it's 10 in the morning, and who knows what he's done all night long. He's trying to figure out where that next bed is going to come from, or meal is going to come mm-hmm. from, or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's a really tough situation that, you know, our young gay kids find themselves in.
And are you finding kids coming from other parts of the country coming here, or is it just mainly the burbs and the people in the city?
I think we're drawing from a lot of, you know, Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're gay from another part of the country, you're probably headed out to San Francisco. Mm. I don't know why anyone would try to migrate to Chicago, you know, with the winters that we sure. have. But certainly, you know, our surrounding counties and suburbs, we're a big destination for freshly out gay kids. Mm-hmm.
What are some things that people don't realize about homeless youth, that some misconceptions that we have besides, you know, that it's glamorous or something? They all sing musicals. But if you're based on homelessness and based on Rent the musical or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, so being homeless is just one facet of their personality, mm-hmm. and just in the same way that being gay is one facet of their personality. So, you know, our homeless gay kids have the same kind of life ambitions and dreams that everyone else does. I wrote a piece for Care for Friends blog a week ago about this girl, Jackie. And she grew up in the suburbs, and she had, you know, all of the affluence, you know, financial services, father and mom was really excited about, you know, her career. She got into college. Mom and dad went down to college and said, how do we get her into law school? And then at the end of her sophomore year, you know, she's chasing a triple major. She's pre-law. And she calls home to say, you know, I'm getting straight A's. And by the way, I met this girl in college and I have a girlfriend. And her parents immediately cut her off. And so said, you know, hung up the phone, had their brother call a couple of days later and say, mom and dad cut off your credit cards. Your phone's going to be turned off at the end of the month. You know, they want the car returned back to this location, or they're going to call the police and report it stolen. And, you know, don't know how you're going to finish college or do what else you're going to do. But we want nothing to do with you anymore. And so, you know, that's who our homeless kids are. It's the same kind of career aspirations and goals that everyone else has. They just suddenly have lost the infrastructure underneath.
That's really just heartbreaking. And part of it is, you know, like I think about those kind of situations, like I wonder if like people who get kicked out by their parents, do they go, oh, you know, I was just joking.
So, well, because sure, I mean, the consequences go yeah. back in the closet. Yeah. For sure. There's a lot of people. Oh, I was mistaken or something. Yeah. I've seen it happen to people before.
Well, and so many gay people are told, you know, you can change. You know, go pray about it and it'll come back. And I think, you know, I give kids a lot of credit who come out. My own coming out process took me a long time. You know, I had professional issues that I was thinking about, but, you know, it's a lot of things you need to think about, and we've all had our own coming out journey. You know, what's the trade-off? And eventually, you know, we all kind of get to the point that I know it's going to come with some pain, but it's going to be worth it in the long run. But kids are now, you know, wrestling with that younger and younger and dealing with consequences younger and younger too.
When you were running this very successful startup, it was when it went, had its IPO, it was the largest, what was it? It was the largest tech company to have an IPO. It was the largest IPO of a tech company. And for people who are not familiar with the stock market or how it works, that means that this tech company started offering shares of its stock and it became the most valuable tech company before Google came into being.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. So in addition to running Care for Friends, I have a day job working in sales and technology. And my first job was at a small startup. It was in the late 90s. And so we were selling a product that helped people build websites. So I began there. I wasn't the CEO at that point. I was just a regular sales rep. And my sales pitch was kind of like, hey, I'm calling from the internet.
What was the name of the company?
It was called Vignette.
Vignette. And they were pioneers in, to really simplify this, is like, the internet used to be static documents, just like if you were pulling Microsoft Word documents off of somebody's computer. And then came this technology called XML, which allowed to separate the content with what you see on a website. And that's what gave rise to podcasts, to RSS feeds, to all this good stuff. Basically, the way that we use the internet today.
Absolutely.
Social media. And you guys, as a company, created software that allowed companies like American Airlines, Amazon, to get their start, to start doing shopping carts and all that stuff.
All of that kind of stuff. Yeah.
So you guys like built the internet from scratch.
We did. Now, I was not the smart one. I was just a sales guy.
But you were involved in this
company.
But
I was involved with it. And I was very fortunate. Yeah. You know, I was 24 years old. I started at this company. They had sold, you know, $700,000 in that year, which I thought was a ton of money. 6 years later, the company was selling $9 billion a year.
Wow.
We had 6,000 employees. We went public, you know, did all of that kind of stuff.
It's a good thing you didn't work for pets.com.
We probably built their website.
But you would call people and say, hello, I'm from the internet.
That was basically my sales pitch. And I thought, I don't know why everyone doesn't go into sales. This is like the easiest message. Hey, I'm from the internet. Do you need a web page? And exactly as you said, all the newspapers did and the airlines did and the car companies did. So it was a really nice kind of start. But so that experience really launched me into a tech sales career, where ever since then I've worked with a variety of software companies, helping to streamline their sales organizations. So over time, you know, I got better skills. I became a sales manager. I became the VP of sales. I've been the CEO of companies. Now we call it the chief revenue officer. I run sales and marketing for a tech company. And I forgot how we got down this path, but.
Well, and so in this journey, you were at this point in your life, you were this very successful leader in a company, and yet you were very terrified to come out as gay to your coworkers.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And you were telling me that, like, still in this day and age, like, an incredibly high number of people are terrified to come out as LGBTQ.
Half of gay workers aren't out at work. And it took me, I was the CEO of the company before I came out.
And I know this because whenever I tell people that I'm gay, their eyes get all huge. Like, and I'm like, baby, this is 2019. Come on.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I work at a bakery and you work in a, you know.
Well, but you know, people think about what's it going to do to my career? What's it going to do to my professional reputation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, we still live in, you know, across the country, you can get fired for being gay. There are not legal protections in many, many states, and certainly not nationally. It's not a protected class. So you really have to think twice about it.
And not only is it not a protected class, but it can actually be quite hostile work environment for you if you are an LGBT person and you're out. You know, you're ridiculed, you're mocked, you're beaten up. All sorts of things can happen to you.
Absolutely. And so it wasn't until I was the CEO and I was like, well, I'm basically the boss here. Now I can walk into the office and say, hey, I'm the new.
Hey,
hey,
hey girl.
I'm the new guy in town. And you know, it wasn't a big announcement, but I made sure it was my first day on the job. And I made sure I was making comments about, you know, the guy who now is my husband, but, you know, making those references and kind of letting people know, this is going to be a safe place, and this is my reality, too.
J.D. Miller is forcing his lifestyle at work by showing his wedding ring on to us.
Absolutely.
How did you react to that? How did you handle those kind of comments?
Well, you know, I didn't get a lot of pushback. I was actually fortunate. I was the CEO, and I was the big boss, and no one was going to say anything to me about
things
it.
Things have changed, but there are still some very backward people out there, of course.
Yeah.
Well, what do you say, like, to the CEOs, like the guy who runs T-Mobile, Apple? Who are some, like, CEOs?
Tim Cook.
Peter Thiel of PayPal. He's a Trump supporter.
Yeah, you know, I think it really is about being visible. You know, if you as the CEO can't be out at work, how do you think your employees who are making much less money than you are going to feel comfortable and safe there?
It does make it easy to come out as LGBTQ when the leadership of the company you work for is out and proud and is vetting nonprofits so they're not donating money to, like, you know, the Susan J. Coleman or the Salvation Armies of the world. And instead you're doing to, like, good charities that actually do work and have very low overheads.
Yeah. So it was interesting to me this fall, Crain's Chicago Business, it's a business magazine in Chicago, did this, you know, 85 LGBT executives in Chicago, notable executives. And I was one of the 80. Thank you.
Can you give me their email addresses? Because we're trying to raise money.
Absolutely. But, you know, we're at like a, a reception for this.
So you had a party.
They had a party.
Oh, my God.
They were asking for money, too. But I had a reception. And it was amazing how many of the people said, you know, when I was approached to receive this award, I wasn't sure if I was going to take it because I had to wrestle with my name's going to be in the paper as LGBT. And they're CEOs and big name titles. So, you know,
for a lot of them, it was the way to come out of the closet.
Yeah. Or they had been out to a couple of people. And And so you think if it's hard for that kind of person to come out, how rough is it for the 14, 15, 16 year old kid whose parents are fundamentalist Christians and telling them they're going to go to hell? And how do you make all of that work?
So who's the most like exotic, eccentric, queer CEO that you've met so far?
Oh, gosh.
I can tell you who I think it is. The guy who runs T-Mobile, he's off the wall on social media.
Who is he?
I don't know. CEO of T-Mobile. Like, I run into people who have slept with him and stuff and all the time. And they're like, his name is John
Legere. Oh,
and he like it's not a coincidence that T-Mobile's color is pink. I'll just say it that way.
I love it.
But he seems like a really, you know, a person with good head on his shoulders. But he's very eccentric.
You know, I don't know if I have eccentricity, but there's a woman that I met actually through the Cranes thing who's actually also going to sleep out with us. And she's trans.
Sleeping with women again.
Oh, she's trans and she runs a company called Hard Hats and High Heels. And so she and her wife stand out as construction workers with the signs on the poles and tell people when to start and stop traffic. and I think about what courage that must take to be, first of all, a woman in construction and then an out trans woman in construction and all of those battles that might need to get fought. And I just love that, although not eccentric in the way you talked about other CEOs, I love that she created this winking title for her company called Hard Hats and High Heels, too.
So she's got a good head on her shoulder. What?
You build it, they will come.
Yes. But so she has a good head on her shoulders. She's not like fighting with people on Twitter.
No, she's actually
like
really
John Legere does that.
You know? Oh, really?
Good, good for the community.
That's wonderful. Oh, no.
Sorry.
That's okay. I want to remind folks that Feast of Fun is made possible because of your generous contributions. Right now, we are trying to save the equipment that we use to produce this podcast. If you go to GoFundMe.com/Feast of Fun, save Feast of Fun, you can help us continue into the years to come. We are here today because of the support of fabulous people like you, J.D. Miller.
Get out those credit cards.
That's right, people. Save Feast of Fun. And right now, we have made it to $2,007.
And our goal is $3,500.
Yes. I want to do a shout out to Sean Lipensky, Jake Tolan, Ophelia Joyhole.
Oh, Ophelia.
Stephen Howell, Oscar Torres, Joe Adame, Kyle Coffin, Jeff Wright, Mark Sanford, Mike Stabler, John Smith, David McCullough, Gary Ballinger, Reed Loveland, Larry LaFontaine, and so many other people. You guys have been friends of ours and listeners all these years. We're deeply grateful that we've gone this far. 33 donors made it possible. You can go to GoFundMe.com/SaveFeastOfFun. And help us be around for years to come.
Thank you so much for your support. It really means a lot.
Now, this is where we get into the hot tea of the show. JD's going to talk about being an intern for the Bill Clinton White House at the same time as Monica Lewinsky.
The same class.
Absolutely, yes.
What happened?
So it's an intern class? Is that...
How does this work?
Yeah, so I was in college. I thought I was going to go to law school. And part of the pre-law program was, you know, go get an internship. So I had a friend who had been a White House intern, and she said, you should apply to be a White House intern. And they took 100 of us a semester. And so, you know, flew out to D.C. and got to go to work in the White House every day.
And Monica Lewinsky was just one among 100 other people. So it's not like you got to know her that well. And she was just as attractive and charismatic as other men and women in your group.
Absolutely. And she and I had very different jobs to do.
Okay.
But
I'll say.
But much like the, you know, she worked in legislative affairs and I worked in the president's scheduling office.
She was
office.
In affairs, huh?
And so, you know, I didn't have a great relationship, a close relationship with her. As, you know, much like the girl who sat in your math class, you know, two rows down, knew who she was, knew her name, and, you know, have some pictures that she's in.
And so, but, so you don't have any tea to spill with that?
But you heard there were some rumors, right, while you were there, but you didn't think much of it?
Yeah, or? So we had a ton of rumors. You know, you think about the government as this, you know, big institution where everyone puts on suits and ties every day and has a big grown-up job. But there were rumors about so many things going on that summer. So, you know, I'm old, so that was back in summer of 96. There's, you know, people are talking about Vince Foster committing suicide and, you know, all sorts of stuff going on. And of course, Monica was a rumor as well. But it wasn't until the next year.
What was the rumor at the time?
I mean, you know, exactly what the news wound up being is that she was having an affair in the Oval Office.
Okay. So you guys knew about this before it was public.
Had heard that story. Didn't believe it at the time.
It seemed highly unlikely.
Yeah, it seemed, you know, it seemed, didn't believe it. Never saw it myself. Yeah. Didn't think it to be true. But then, you
so
know, a year later, it starts
that
showing up on the news.
People were gossiping about her.
I'm sure. Well, I'm sure. And Linda Tripp as well, you know, was not keeping that a secret either. So it was about a year later, I was done with the internship and started to, you know, hear the news. And at first I was like, yeah, I've kind of heard that story before. I'm surprised they're running with it. But then, you know, the same story and the same story and the same story kept coming out. And of course, then we discovered the whole thing and it was all on, you know, tape and the rest of it and the blue dress. So it was an interesting time.
What do you make about Republicans comparing today's impeachment proceedings to Bill Clinton's impeachment proceedings?
Not at all the same. You know, Bill Clinton was impeached on, you know, looking for an excuse to impeach him on something he did in his private life. And, you know, the Me Too movement maybe makes us think very different things about, you know, a relationship with a boss and their subordinate. Yeah. And there's a lot to be discussed there, but it's not quite the same thing. And in my mind anyway, as actually asking foreign countries to intervene in your elections.
Cause that was a big factor why House Democrats were reluctant to proceed with impeachment proceedings, even though it was very clear that Trump has always broken the law and has been like, what are you going to do about it? Kind of like a bully, you know?
Well, you know, it's very brazen. I was listening to the impeachment hearings today, and one of the House representatives talked about in the Nixon impeachment and in the Clinton impeachment, both of those presidents said, I'm going to fully comply with the subpoenas. I'm going to make my staff and my records and everyone else available. This is the first impeachment we're going through where the president is blocking his staff from participating, fighting every subpoena along the way, and not participating in the process in a candid or transparent
way. Do you think that's going to work out in Trump's favor?
I don't know. I mean, I certainly think he's been able to delay and delay and delay, and we've got an election coming up. So, you know, regardless of what you think of this president, you should be an active voting citizen. And, you know, if he's not impeached, he may be able to run down the clock and get to the next election. And then it's really up for us as citizens to decide, you know, do we want to continue on with this for another 4 years?
Can we even trust the results of the next election?
Well, we'll see. Who knows?
I mean, it's like, you know, right now on social media, there's this article that's being spread by everybody saying it's like, you know, all these young people registered to vote.
2 million registered to vote.
In the UK.
Yeah.
It's in like, the fine print, it says in the UK. And everyone's like, yay, I don't have to vote.
And part of me thinks it's like Facebook is probably pushing this in a way to get people here in the United States to think that all these young people are registered to vote. Oh, I don't need to vote. The young kids are going to take care of it because now there's 2 million of them. But check the data on it. It's from the UK.
Well, and we have made it very easy for people to register to vote now. And so in the last presidential election, you know, there's a big deal made out of, you know, record turnout. And it was like 60 or 65% of eligible voters actually did. 65% turnout is actually really terrible when you look at how many people go vote in foreign countries. It's a right that we have. It's the one thing that you can do to really change your destiny. And there's no reason, if you're not listening right now, you should go get registered and then go exercise your voice.
Oh, hold on a second. This tambourine's driving me nuts.
Sorry.
It was about to... Anyway, now, yeah.
You brought up the blue dress. I should tell you the story about this guy. So this guy had a bone marrow transplant because... he had, you know, cancer, right? And so they went to look at his body after the bone marrow transplant, and they did certain swabs to look at his DNA. So his blood and his blood system is 100% the donor's blood now, because it's changed. So now he's got the donor's blood running through his body. They did swabs of his mouth and his lips, and that also has donor DNA in it. The only place, like, in his body that didn't have the donor DNA was the hair on his scalp and on his chest. And the sperm in his body produced was 100% donor DNA. So this guy basically is, like, disappearing, but is still staying the same.
This is some Forensic Files stuff going on.
Isn't that wild?
So scientists have discovered that a recipient of bone marrow transplants,
the stem cells,
most of the DNA in his body is changing, but his physical appearance is still staying the same.
Well, pretty much still staying the same. Now, I posted this, you know,
that's shocking and profound news, because it means that what we understand of a person's phenotype, the way they appear, and their genotype, the code of their DNA, is way dramatically different than what we thought before. And here's some hard evidence showing that.
So, I mean, it really shows a lot that maybe with gene therapies, who knows what could happen, you know, in the future. And Daisy Pusher, a drag queen friend of ours on Facebook, I posted this, and she said that his uncle, or her uncle, because he's a drag queen, got a bone marrow transplant from his mother, and that he was a real asshole before. And that his, like, ever since he got the bone marrow transplant from his mother, who was a kind and gentle person, he has become a nicer person. And it's not just because of, you know, he thinks it's not just because of the being grateful to not have cancer anymore, but because it actually did something to him physically.
Picking up a little bit of someone else.
Of someone else, having maybe some, like, that female energy, that empathy kind of thing.
That's really cool.
Profound. Yeah. That's profound.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, in terms of, like, fighting these kind of physical ailments, it's definitely going to be a profound change in how we think about genetics, disease, illness, and solutions and treatments.
And also, I mean, the ethics, I mean, this guy could go out and make a baby with somebody else, and it wouldn't even be his kid.
And the baby might not even look like him.
What would be the other guy's kid?
And what if this other guy is, like, African-American, or, like, dramatically different appearance?
Yeah, or like...
Is the guy white, or do we know the
race? He's, like, white. Yeah. But he, what was I going to say? I mean, the point of it is, too, is, like, so, like, let's say he goes out, gets this woman pregnant, and then he, like, runs out of the picture. Who's responsible for that baby now?
Well, obviously it is. So, you know, I want to get your thoughts a little bit more into this idea of the controversy with Pete Buttigieg, who is one of the top Democratic candidates. He might get the ticket. He could be our next president. And, you know, for quite some time, he came out in 2015 in his second run for mayor of South Bend, Indiana. And that same year, he started participating with the Salvation Army to raise funds as a bell ringer. And he did a lot of photo ops. In 2017, he actually was photographed. And most recently, those photos have been made onto the internet and causing a lot of division, a lot of anger, and people saying, why are you supporting? I mean, Chick-fil-A this past year cut ties with Salvation Army because of their homophobia and transphobia. What do you have to make about that? Or what advice would you give to somebody like Pete Buttigieg?
Well, I guess the optimist in me is happy that he's doing something good, and whatever caused him to get there, Hopefully it's become a habit for him now. And so if he becomes the president, you know, I hope he continues to support the Salvation Army and advance their mission and advance their goals.
But Chick-fil-A doesn't even want to support the Salvation Army, and they're the homophobic ones, you know. Salvation Army was so harmful to LGBTQ people that even Chick-fil-A doesn't want to be associated with them anymore. Think about that.
Actually, yeah, I'm actually
that's
not
profound,
that.
You know. And to me, it's like, I don't like, to me, it kind of illustrates the value of being part of a community. Which is, if Pete Buttigieg really wants to be our next president and he wants to, you know, be the deal maker to make these conservative organizations be more kinder and understanding of the needs of LGBTQ people and not harm us, not create a divisive world, he needs to understand where we're coming from in order to have that conversation. He can't advocate for us when he doesn't know us. Even he may have, you may be out as gay, but have you hung out with, you know, with Care for Friends and spent a night in the tent? No, he hasn't.
Yeah, well, and admittedly, I probably need to do some education of my own on Salvation Army, because I think I'm learning things sitting here, too.
And so, I have a list.
Yeah, yeah.
In 1997, they fought against universal health care in the city of San Francisco. In 2008, they denied a trans woman shelter, which led to her death. In Austin, Texas, in 2013, they were caught referring vulnerable people, LGBT people in our organization, to conversion torture groups. In 2016, they fought against protecting LGBT youth from bullying in public schools in Australia. And so they're using the money that we're thinking is going to support homeless people in those red buckets. And a portion of them definitely goes to help them. But another portion of that goes to advancing their very conservative viewpoints that are harmful to people, including LGBT youth.
Sure.
And homeless youth.
Well, I suppose he is learning that with great power comes great responsibility. Sure. Yeah. And so, you know, he becomes a mouthpiece for these sorts of things. And, you know, as a donor, as a volunteer, you really need to get educated about what you're supporting.
He could have Googled it. He could have Wikipedia'd.
Yeah, and you should
know,
have.
I mean, as a politician, you know, at least read the Wikipedia entry of the organization you're going to support.
Sure, sure.
I did for you. It took me 15 minutes. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm thinking, like, you know, and part of me is like, I know I worked with people like Pete when I worked at the Chicago Free Press and the newspaper. I think the owner of that paper actually reminded me a lot of Pete Buttigieg, in the sense that, like, you know, there's a lot of pain and suffering and unreconciled trauma when we come out as gay or trans or LGBTQ, and we come from very conservative backgrounds. And so when we're out and about, we sort of have this messiah complex. And I noticed that, like, I have friends who do this. They're like, suddenly they discover some horrible crime that everybody knows about, and they're the ones who are going to solve it because they're the Johnny come latelys. They came into the picture and they know something that everybody else doesn't. And part of it is, like, you know, in terms of leadership, and you know this, and I know this, and a lot of people do, great leaders are it's a servant job. It's a job where you are listening. You are leading from behind. You are taking advice from people and you're making sense of it and disseminating it. You're not telling other people what to do. You're listening to their advice.
And you're absolutely, and you're setting direction as well. So yeah. Kind of thinking back to our discussion about CEOs coming out and mm-hmm. all of a sudden it's a safe place, you know, when a candidate, or if he becomes president, you know, makes a small offhand comment, the rest of the world listens very closely and follows and will barrel down that path because they're a supporter. So it really does. It really does mean, you know, he will have a lot of great power and really needs to be very careful and thoughtful in everything that he does.
Yeah. I mean, but that's true for anybody.
It is.
You know,
but the higher you go, I think the higher you go in, like, your career or in politics, or you with, the, yeah. you know, a huge audience and huge listeners, you have to weigh your words a lot more carefully than someone who has five people listening to them.
Well, and part of it is, like, I'd like to think that, you know, the times that we've said dumb things or made mistakes, that our audience is willing to talk to us about it and that we're capable of listening to them.
Yeah. And extend some grace and give people room to make mistakes. And then hopefully people grow from it as well and learn and mm-hmm. can say, I was wrong, or I did something poorly.
But I think if we want to seriously fight homelessness in this country and advocate the needs of youth, we have to advocate for universal health care. We need to advocate for increasing the minimum wage.
Absolutely.
Our cost of living is not keeping in pace with our income. And young people today are the poorest, the least financially comfortable generation ever.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, it's very easy to get into bumper sticker kind of statements about, you know, why don't homeless people just go get a job or pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the truth is a lot of homeless people have jobs. We in Chicago, we've got 25,000 employed homeless people. They're the people who are cleaning your hotel room or checking you out at the super center or, you know, bagging your groceries. But still,
I have coworkers
aren't getting by.
That don't have a regular place to sleep at night and sometimes sleep in their cars.
Yeah.
You know, and part of it is like, and they're working full, they're pulling up themselves by their own bootstraps, but it's still not enough.
Right.
And we have construction going on next door, and Foster's always complaining about, why do they start so early? They start so early and then they're done by 2 o'clock. I'm like, well, they probably go to their other job.
Right. Right.
You know?
And so if you're going to address an issue like homelessness, there's a lot of systemic stuff like mental health and physical health care. You know, people have to decide often between, am I going to pay my rent? Am I going to buy groceries? Or am I going to pay that medical bill that just came in? And, you know, you pick the wrong one of those and suddenly, you know, you're in a downward spiral and then it all falls apart for you. So, you know,
I have a friend of mine who is advocating, is a very kind, very generous person. And he's like, I don't believe in food stamps. I think the government should get rid of food stamps. Like, well, totally.
Maybe he should be our next president.
And I said to him, I was like, you know, food stamps isn't, if you believe that you should have food stamps, if you should apply for them for sure. But food stamps affect us all in lowering the cost of our grocery store bill. A lot of grocery stores wouldn't be in business if it wasn't for food stamp programs. And if there wasn't any food stamp programs, the ones that were still in business, like Whole Foods, you think your Whole Foods bill is high? Without food stamps, it'd be 3 or 4 times higher.
Right. Well, grocery stores certainly are operating on, really, really tight margins and every dollar counts there. But I think you're exactly right that if you want to make change in the world, it's not just putting a dollar in the Salvation Army's bucket. Hopefully you're going to put it in Care for Friends bucket, but only because we're really going to be looking at how do you solve kind of all of the interdependent issues and how does one thing lead to the next and give people a firm foundation to stand on.
Have you guys talked about or thought about approaching Chick-fil-A and say, you know, we're LGBT friendly. We need the money. We'll put it to good use.
You know,
just saying. You don't have to answer that.
I'm a really small organization. I don't think I can get their ear. But
if they want to, you know, change their public image,
but Chick-fil-A, if you're listening to Feast of Fun today, absolutely. You know, get in touch with Mark and Fausto, and they'll put you in touch with me. I'd be happy to have the conversation.
That you guys as a nonprofit organization have these conversations all the time, like who you're associating yourself with, where your money's coming from, and, you know, how it affects your public image.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the, you know, it's a good thing and a bad thing about what we do. Serving a hot meal on a regular basis is a really attractive volunteer opportunity for companies. And a lot of companies will come with a check as well and say, you know, you've got 150 homeless people. Can you take 20 volunteers? And, you know, we'll also pay you for it. And the truth is running a nonprofit is about fundraising. You need to get money somewhere. But we do have to think very carefully about who do we say yes to and how are they going to use that experience in their own marketing or media, social media and pictures and the rest of it. And really be careful about who you associate with.
Amazing. Well, I hope that you guys have a huge turnout this year in February. What night is it going to be?
It's going to be February 21st, and we still have spots available. People can register at...
Oh, so it's like a hotel.
Absolutely. We got 200 tents.
It might fill up.
It will fill up.
Get in now.
Well, get in now. You can go register at cffsleeps.com, and that's Care for Friends Sleeps.com.
Can you bring your inflatable mattress and portable heater? And
we are pretty tolerant of a lot of things. If you're willing to sleep with us and you're willing to ask your friends to donate money to support you, we'll make space for a lot of stuff.
Wow. So what's the so if somebody wants to participate with that, what's the minimum they need to raise to? Because this is like a AIDS charity fundraiser, like a marathon, right?
Yeah. You know, we don't have a fundraising minimum.
Okay.
We used to, and we discovered that actually when people just opened their networks, they far exceeded any minimums we ever set. So what's most important to us is that you sign up and you have your friends sign up and bring people along. It's always a better party if you got more people sleeping with you. So come on along and get other people encouraged to do it.
Come sleep with JD Miller. He's available.
February 21st.
But not in that way.
It certainly sounds like a fun event, and it really goes to an incredible cause. And I wish, you know, everybody that could participate in that. And if they can't participate in that, figure out some way where you can help LGBT homeless youth somewhere in the world.
Well, and if you can't be a sleeper, you know, go to cffsleeps.com and support one of our sleepers with your dollars, too.
Right on.
First, buy a microphone for Feast of Fun, and then and then throw some bucks our way.
I got to tell you, you know, I already started putting that money to use, and we got new microphones. I don't know if you can hear it, but it's like having new shoes. Mm-hmm. You know, when your foot's sticking out the bottom and put on a new shoe, you're like, oh my god, it's like I can breathe again. You know, this microphone that I was talking on, it was having the mange. It was like dropping black dust onto my
keyboard.
You're
probably inhaling that.
Yeah, probably not healthy for it. It's because these microphones are wrapped with this foam inside, and basically when they start to disintegrate and all this stuff. And these microphones are, you know, almost as old as I am.
Well,
so it's like really they have a history.
I'll tell the listeners that, you know, it's been money really well spent. It's a professional environment that's not too extravagant and wasteful. They've invested in quality equipment for a quality product and not being wasteful in it as well.
I appreciate that.
I wanted to end the show with talking about the power of listening and the power of this podcast in helping you come to terms with your own sexual identity. Because when you started listening to the show, you were in a relationship, a long-term relationship with a woman.
Yes.
And you started explaining to her how your enthusiasm for Feast of Fun, and she was like, said, are you gay, JD?
She never actually asked that question. No, she never got to that question. But I do think, and this is maybe a topic for us to come back and talk about another time. Yeah. But you know, I think podcasts are really interesting because although you're speaking to thousands of people, it's a very one-on-one, very intimate connection. Like you're physically in my ear every day, and the words you speak are kind of influencing people's brains and thoughts and how they approach the world. And so I stumbled upon your podcast years ago, and at the time I wasn't in a place in my life that I was like, oh, I'm going to seek out a gay podcast, but it wound up in the feed, and over time, it, you know, things started to resonate, and you know, things that I always knew about myself and maybe didn't want to wrestle with, you guys helped me have that conversation with myself, and then eventually have that conversation with the rest of the world, too. So,
meanwhile, we were talking about, you know, stuff we saw on TV that made us giggle, or like the sweaters on Walmart that had a snowman snorting cocaine. Walmart pulled them off the shelves. How did what moment in the history of the show stood out for you that made you think twice about yourself? Is there a moment that you can reflect on and say, this episode specifically?
I wish I had one for you. I don't think I had a big, you know, awakening.
When George Takei said, oh my, I have feasted with fun fools on Feast of Fools.
Yeah, I think it was much more about, you know, little baby steps and getting to put a toe in the water and then take it back and put a toe in the water and take it back. Mm. So, you know, the gay community is a really complex place that's different than straight people inhabit.
That's an understatement.
And there's a lot of stuff to learn, a lot of stuff to know about. And, you know, it's got a whole language and all sorts of stuff going on with it. And so, you know, when I started to, you know, explore that part of myself, you know, I think I probably drew on lessons that I picked up all along the way about, you know, how do you treat people respectfully and how do you keep yourself safe and how do you manage that? And how do you look to the culture and find fun, frivolous things to enjoy, too?
I just want to say how proud I am of you, of where you come so far in your life and how you're making things better for people who are the most vulnerable in the world. I think it's fantastic what you're doing. And I'm so touched and moved by the fact that we had some tiny bit to do with that. So thank you for letting us know how we affected your life.
Yeah, it means a lot to us, especially at Christmas now, because it's like, it's the holidays. It's a time of sentimentalness and nostalgia and doing good out in the world. And it's nice to know that we were able to help you a little bit. And you are in turn helping a lot of young people out there. And it's just, you know, it warms my heart.
Well, thanks for including me in your life. And then tomorrow we can talk about Santa lost a hoe and get back to the...
like that in Pocahontas, yeah. The movie, the willow tree. Mm-hmm. She says, like, we're just two people. What can we do? And she says, the ponds, the ripples in the water start small, but they go out far and wide.
Yeah, and you never know where you're going to... You've touched thousands of people, and some you'll get to come in and sit down and tell you about it.
And lawsuits.
Many you'll never find out.
Just kidding.
Just kidding.
I'm very respectful, you know.
Yeah.
So far.
That is a question we do get asked all the time. But, you know, we're actually opening ourselves up to a very vulnerable space as well. And you are asking me, like, have we had people who have violated that trust or harmed us to some degree? And I would say yes. But generally speaking, if you're willing to come into two gay guys' apartment and talk unfiltered for an hour about the things that most matter to you, and you're willing to make yourself that vulnerable, you can't be that bad of a person if you're willing to expose yourself to the world that way, and that you trust us to make sure that we take care of you as much as you take care of us.
Well, I'll tell you, over the years, you know, I think the trust is coming the other way, because I feel like I knew you before I walked in. I knew the name of your dog, and I knew everything about you. You had no idea who you were opening your front door to come on in. So.
I'm really good at searching for things on the internet.
Well, that's why I'll tell you that. When we meet listeners, though, it's almost a lot of times it's an instant connection, because they know us. You know, they know what we sound like. They know how we talk and stuff. And so it's not really a surprise. And because you listen to us, we're going to have that common interest. That's for sure.
JD, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
To say I love you, there are many ways to say I care about you. Many ways, many ways, many ways to say I love you. There are many ways to say I love you, just by being there when things are sad and scary, just by being there, being there, being there to say I love you. Cleaning up a room can say I love you. Hanging up a coat before you're asked to do it. Drawing special pictures for the holidays and making plays. You'll find many ways to say I love you. You'll find many ways to understand what love is. Many ways, many ways, many ways to say I love you.